Hi, this is Terry Kushma here at Penn State University. What we'd like to do today is take a look at material modification in nanotechnology, specifically when I look at DNA and protein analysis and how we would use nanotechnology to solve those problems or look at those materials. So what we're going to do basically is we're going to take a look at microarray technology and how microarrays are used. And then what we're going to have to do is develop some concepts of how we would use microfluidics. So microfluidics is the science of small amounts of fluids on the nanoscale or microscale, and we'll see how where we would use that. And then we'll take a look at some hardware, basically, and some materials that we would use quite often to accomplish the task of building microfluidic devices. So let's look at, you know, an application first. I think it's good to see what we're trying to build and why we're trying to build a certain device, and then we're going to look at the science to do that. So a microbiology lab chip, it's a device that can dissect a very small amount of DNA, protein, cells, or a drug. It can chemically analyze a liquid sample 10,000 times smaller than commercial analytical instruments that are available today. So this is certainly a time-saving chip that could be built for genetic diagnostics, DNA fingerprinting, and drug research. What this chip does is it conserves media and reduces disposal issues. So this is how they work. Microarrays work by exploiting the ability of mRNA to bind to DNA templates. And what they can do is they would actually able to analyze gene expression. So this is a gene chip from Affymetrix. And that's actually a chip that, you know, I possess. Some students graduated from my program, work for Affymetrix. So they sent me some samples of their work. So how a microarray is used, a test structure can be used with microfluidic technology to interrogate samples. It's used to understand the fundamental aspects of growth and development with DNA. It's also used to identify and classify DNA sequence information and assign their function. So basically what we do, we have this color picture down at the bottom. You might be wondering what that is. And basically what that is a microarray. And why it's a microarray is that it's small, and then it's also an array. And each one of those visual colored spots on there, that they're generally a metal section. And on that metal section, we have a specific encoding, a DNA encoding. And then what we would do is run the patient's sample across that matrix. And if it had that specific encoding in that specific area, what it would do is light up in that response. So that's what we do. We can basically take known DNA sequence on this template, run across a patient's unknown sequence, and when they hybridize together, we're going to be able to see a visual response. So why are microarrays important? Because you can survey a large number of genes quickly. So what we could potentially do is we can develop a chip that might have diseases that are indicative of both, you know, men and women on there. And even though we would use it for a man or a woman, what we can do is just ignore the woman side and when we're doing work with men. And then that way what we can do is just make more of these chips. So when we make these chips, we can make them that they can be used for a multitude of areas, and then that way we can stock less devices in our shell. So what they can do is they can also contrast cells and tissues from being healthy and diseased, and they can actually be used in research to show how genes can work together with other applications. So this is basically what a microarray is. What we're going to do is each section of the microarray, each pixel, what we're going to do is place a specific protein on there. And what we're going to be able to do is take a patient's, shown here in the upper right-hand side, we can take a patient's DNA, tag it with a fluorescent label, then we run it across the targeted DNA that's written on the sample, and when these guys hybridize together and stick, then we're going to be able to see this plasmon on the end. So this is a nice, this application is nice, and the reason, one of the reasons that I teach this application is that it shows this, bottom-up manufacturing techniques. It shows self-assembly. It shows plasmons. It shows all kind of different topics that we would like to discuss in a course like this in bottom-up manufacturing. So this is a really good example of how these scientific tenets work together to produce a product that's valuable to society. So the advantages and disadvantages of these DNA labs on a chip, they're certainly very small, disposable, sealed, and portable, and they have a very fast response time. A disadvantage is probably that it takes the place of a lot of people's jobs. So it takes the intermediate expertise out of this, because basically the device itself is moderately smart. So the device itself, we don't need to have rather intelligent technicians to run this process. It runs automatically through the design of the device, and then all we need to have is an expert do the analysis for that application. It's interesting that in these types of units that they would like to have only people that are medically proficient be able to view the results of this so that they can make assertions to the next step of the patient's care. So for the most part, they don't like to release these for home use, that people could buy these devices and then prescribe their own drugs, per se. They allow the patients come in, these units are performed or used to perform a task on a patient, and then that information is given to a physician that actually would take that data and apply the appropriate response. So let's take a quick look at some microfluidic technology. So we need to build DNA lab on a chip. It's necessary to consider fluidic flow in the micro and nano regime. So that fluid flow is a lot different than the macro flow that we would see in our everyday life, like in a kitchen, bathroom, etc. So this tubing is very resistive. And for the most part, in the microfluidic regime, materials don't mix, and fluid pressure is extremely high. So those are issues that we have to overcome. So microfluidics is the science of designing, manufacturing, and formulating devices and processes that process and handle volumes of fluid on the order of nano or picoliters. And we can see that that's a nice schematic drawing of a device. It's very indicative of what devices look like. You know, they're moderately simple, modular, often that they use light, optical response in their application, to show the results of the process. And it's interesting to note that this uses a small amount of material. 30 nanoliters is on the order of 1,000 of one droplet. So what we see here is if we have a small sample, we can still be able to get some data out of that small sample. So this is important for, research, et cetera, maybe crime scene kind of things or whatever. So, small amounts of material don't prohibit the test from taking place. So this shows the importance of microarrays in society. So this is a recent graph that shows from 2008, where we're going in a short 8 years, the amount of the amount of money to be spent on microfluidics is tremendous. So this just shows us, in some senses, that this provides a lot of jobs, and that it certainly is valuable to society at large. So this shows another way of looking at is technology real? Is the amount of papers that are published on a particular task. We look at this graph here, and it shows the number of papers that are produced between the year 2000 and 2010, and the growth rate is tremendous. So we'll take a look at microfluidic devices. They handle small amounts of fluid. They're good when only small amounts are available, or good for conservation of the material. They use small amounts of energy, and they're also sealed to prevent contamination, so we can trust the assertion that they make. The small size leads to mobility, so we really don't need a lab. At least that is the goal. A lot of times they call these things a chip in a lab because you need additional material or additional computers or lasers or something to ascertain the data that's done on the device itself, because we want the device to be very simple. So no lab is needed. That's questionable. Sometimes we need additional material to analyze the chip because we simply don't want to place a lot of assets on the chip. We would rather have the assets such as a laser or a CCD camera. We would like that to be off of the chip because then the chip is inexpensive and we could reuse that LCD or computer matrix and some other application later. So reactions, because we use a limited amount of material, they can be very fast. There's a lot of applications for lab on a chip now that plug directly into, per se, iPhones or Android devices because they use a small amount of power, so they can piggyback off of a phone battery. And phones nowadays are very complex, and their computational ability is pretty vast. So that's what a lot of materials moving to that direction. So as an overview, microfluidics is a multidisciplinary field intersecting engineering, physics, chemistry, biochemistry, nanotechnology, and bio-nanotechnology, with practical applications to the design of systems which lead to small volumes of fluid on the order of, you know, microliters, nanoliters, picoliters, etc. So they use low energy, and the effects that these machines take, or this tool takes place in, is in the micro domain. So typically fluids are moved, mixed, or separated and other way processed on a chip. Numerous applications employ passive fluid controls techniques like capillary forces, especially in like paper microfluidics. So the size of microfluidics leads to unique conditions and considerations. Factors like surface tension, unique flow characteristics, air traps, and many other factors contribute to the complexity of microfluidics and certainly the design of microfluidics. So we'll briefly examine some selected factors, including flow and mixing. So the physics of flow in a microfluidic device, electrokinetic effects generally termed to describe the movement of ions in a fluid that's subjected to an electric potential. There are two major types of flow in electrokinetic effects. There's electroosmosis, which is the fluid is driven by the sidewalls, and there's electrophoresis, which the fluid flow is basically driven by charged particles within the flow. And basically, I'd like to point out that this fluid regime exists in both cases in any fluid flow on the micro scale. But what we try to do as engineers is we would design the device or the material by adding, per se, ions or salt solutions, etc., to change to modify the fluid so that we would have one of these processes, either electroosmosis or electrophoresis, dominate. And one of the reasons we would like that to be the case is the fluid would be flowing in opposite direction. So we would like one fluid regime to be dominant so that we know which way the fluid is flowing so that we could design valves and chambers, etc. So electroosmosis, if we take a detailed look at this, the chambers, the walls form a charge on them, and then the fluid itself would form an associated charge to match the charge on the walls. So when the walls are negatively charged, what we're going to do is draw a positive charge outside of the material. And so we're going to build a gradient, a charge gradient across the fluid. Naturally, when we're going to try to use bias to excite and draw the fluid to one end of this device, we're going to induce a fluid front shown as concave in the drawing below. That has big implications because when this fluid goes around a bend, it's going to mix or not mix according to this fluid front. So this has long-range implications into our discussion that we're going to look at fluidic mixing later in the presentation. So this is basically fluid driving, moving the fluid, but we also have to look at fluid mixing later. So electroosmotic flow, it generally relates, it's a relates to the electrokinetic effects. It's the surface of the fluid develops a charge, which influences the flow. This creates layers in the fluid which contain different charges, such as the stern and diffuse layers. So this shows the stern and diffuse layers, and it's basically the bias. We're trying to, you know, match the negative to the positive there, those lines of flux. And what it's going to do is set up a gradient, a charge gradient across the fluid. And I always remember electroosmotic flow because of the O in osmotic, the letter O. It, to me, that's like a snake swallowing a mouse. So it's the sidewalls are actually moving the mouse along the digestive tract in the snake, and that's how I remember electroosmotic flow and what it produces. At least that's an analogy in my mind that helps me look at this or analyze this process. So the advantages of this type of flow, there's no moving parts, no wear, low diffusion, and a rather simple design. But issues are that we have rather large voltages to make this happen. We can also have over time chemical absorption to the channel walls. So our fluid is going to change because we're setting up this gradient, this charge gradient within the material. And this could be sensitive to fluid and chemical channel chemistry. And probably one of the largest issues is the heating. So the resistive heating of the fluid, if we have fluids per se, like for example, blood, if we would heat fluid up with you know, to a higher temperature like blood, it's actually going to coagulate. Or egg, you know, if we have like a raw egg and we put heat across it, it turns into a cooked egg. So that Joule heating could be an issue, and it certainly could have ramifications on our tests. So this is used in areas where we could withstand that particular potential. We also have electrophoresis. This is a movement of charged particles or molecules that are subjected to an electric field. So cations move towards the cathode and anions move towards the anode, and it's shown that way there. So basically what we're doing here, and it looks quite a bit like syringe pump flow. And basically we can't use syringe pump flow. Like, the mechanical flow in a microfluidic device doesn't work that well, because the pressure necessary is just tremendous. But when we look at syringe flow at the energy diagram above, we can actually see that the drag on the walls makes the pressure in the center at a lower pressure, and basically that's going to push that gradient to that level. So what we're going to do is have a strong amount in the middle, and then we're going to have drag on the sidewalls. That actually looks like the electroosmotic flow too. So the ions are going to be dragging the material, but basically the sidewalls are going to have resistance as drag. So that's called more of a plug flow. And again, if we would look at this flow versus the flow regime in electroosmosis, we can see that head on the flow is different. And when we can actually, I guess, look to the future, our discussion when these materials enter into different volumes or go around a bend, it's going to impact our ability to mix the fluid. It's going to enhance or decrease that ability. So we basically have to take in consideration these fluid flow regimes. This is very complex. And is certainly done. A few things can be done on a piece of paper, back of the envelope approximations, like all engineers do for all applications. But this is very, very complex. Fluidic flow on the macro or micro regime has a tremendous amount of variables. So this work and the approximation of fluid flow and how these things actually work is often done by software packages on really you know, costly computers that have a lot of computational ability, because this is so difficult to ascertain because of all the variables. So what we're looking at in this presentation, because this is an introductory presentation, an overview presentation, we're looking at back of the envelope calculations. And if we really wanted to do this per se, like at a company, we would be purchasing microfluidic software, which is, you know, specialty, like a MathCAD type of application, to be able to discern this stuff because it's so complex. So mechanical micropumps, Fluidics using these pumps delivered delivers a small volume of pump. Generally, these things create a pulsating flow, just like a heart. So these are reciprocating pumps. And these pumps basically look a lot like a capacitor. So they close and they open a diaphragm, and it allows fluid to flow. So these are piezoelectric pumps. And naturally, when you apply a voltage to a piezoelectric, you get mechanical displacement. We're going to use that mechanical displacement to move fluid. So generally, fluids at the microscale don't want to mix. Pressure waves affect mixing. Curves in the design might cause mixing. Materials may have intrinsic properties that cause mixing or non-mixing. And because there are many variables, like I said before, computers are often used to look at these issues in detail. But certainly, we need to have a place, you know, an initial look and some back of the envelope calculations or an overview of the process to help understand it. But when you need to know things in detail, you're going to fall back and use a computer to look at those details. So when we look at fluidic particles, when they're on the micro scale, it's interesting that the fluids don't want to mix. What they would do is remain in parallel for often for long periods of time. So we can see in our diagram on the right, when we take these materials and we mix them together, they stay in their own regime. They don't mix. So we can probably assume when we make a microfluidic device that we want it to mix because we probably want a reaction to take place. So we have to have a way of figuring out how to mix these devices. So this is laminar flow. So laminar flow is the standard flow that we would see in a microfluidic device. So when we enter two fluids in a microfluidic device, for the most part, they stay separated. How we would get around this is, what we can do is we can have a number of mixes and bends and turns. And at each turn, what will happen is the fluid will begin to mix. So this is very useful and a lot better design than having something in there like impellers or mechanical mixing. So we're just doing this basically having physical resistance of the sidewall to actually produce eddy currents within the material. So fluid mixing, dealing with liquids on the amount of nanoliters, which again, 30 nanoliters is about a thousandth of a droplet. The reactions, thankfully, recur in milliseconds, but the macro mixing methods that we're used to really don't work that well, such as mechanical mixers, you know, like a spoon or whatever, or an impeller. What we generally rely on is bends and turns to increase the channel mixing. So what we're going to do to define this mixing is, and to get a baseline, we could develop what's called the Reynolds number, which has been used for a long time, right? So it's named after Osborne Reynolds, and he lived from 1824 to 1912. And what he did is develop these expressions to take a look at a limited number of parameters to see if the material is mixing in this regime or not mixing. So the Reynolds number is a relative number that is going to be compared to a chart to say whether we have mixing or not. So basically, in the initial Reynolds equation here, the simplistic one, we have these certain dimensions, the pipe diameter, the fluid velocity, the fluid density, and the fluid viscosity. And from that the simple equation, what we would do is develop a number. So Reynolds liquids flow smoothly when they have a low Reynolds number. Microchannels with only tens of microns dimensions create small Reynolds numbers, creating turbulent, linear turbulent free streams. So mixing could be desirable to have a reaction, and low Reynolds numbers prevent mixing. So for the most part, the natural tendency for fluids in a microfluidic device are to have a low Reynolds number, and at these low Reynolds numbers, we will not have mixing. So we have to have, some pathway to increase these Reynolds numbers to get mixing, because the assumption is we want to have a reaction take place by mixing. So if we look at a laminar flow for really small numbers, we're going to have laminar flow. For numbers that are really large, we'll have turbulent flow. So this is the flow regime is also indicative of the geometry of the device. So if we look at a cylindrical device, we would say that we're going to have mixing or laminar flow below 2100. And for parallel walls, wide open channels, and around a sphere, those are the numbers that are necessary. So again, let's take a quick look at an example. If we want to say, if we have water, and we get the lookup of chemistry handbook, et cetera, to get the parameters for water. We can put that in a simple equation. We plug and chug, and we come out with a Reynolds number of 0.056. And we know in a, if we go back to our chart here, in a cylindrical pipe, numbers that are less than 2100, we're going to have laminar flow. When we put in the parameters for water within these dimensions, we come out with a number of 0.056. So we know that this material is not going to be mixing. It's going to, the material will run in a laminar fashion within a design of this size. So certainly what we could do is any number of these variables, we can change, and we're going to shift them if we wanted to have turbulent flow so that our resultant Reynolds number is much greater than 2100. So we would work on these variables, such as certainly to make the Reynolds number bigger. We can see in this equation, this being in the denominator, what we're going to do is make D like really big. So we might do something like make this 5,000 or something, and then that would give us a number that is a lot bigger that would give us turbulent flow. We also not only have that mechanical flowing of the fluid or mechanical mixing of the fluid, we can have another parameter. Well, there's many parameters. There's probably a dozen parameters. But a second look at a parameter is called the Peclet number. And basically, this works on the velocity of the fluid and the diffusion coefficient. So the diffusion coefficient is the chemical affinity for the material to mix together. So if there's a strong, per se, like ionic concentration of the material, then that could elicit a fluid flow across a boundary. So we certainly have the mechanical fluid flowing that we would look at with the simple equation in microfluidics, and then we have the simple regime of the Peclet number, which examines the fixed law diffusion properties of different chemistries. So the Peclet number, when fluids flow laminarly, the primary means of mass transportation is diffusion, and this is an extremely slow process. To allow for mixing, quicker mixing to occur, we can change the fluid so that it's turbulent. So what we would do is change, per se, the ionic concentration, and we can also change this by mechanical means by putting bends within our microfluidic device. So mixers and stirrers, the microfluids, as we discussed before, generally have laminar flow. What we're going to have is probably the strong desire to have mixing, so we can do this in different modes. Probably one of the most prevalent mixers is a serpentine mixer, and basically we go from different areas, different physical areas. We go from a small area to a large area, and when we do that, we would have mixing. So if we look at our discussion here in this column, the column on the left, we have a rather low Reynolds number. So a low Reynolds number is indicative of no mixing. And if we would take it through these cycles around these bends and changes in volume, and we cycle one, two through and run it through here one time, and then we run it through a second time and then a third time through this geometry, this is what happens to our mixture. So we can get a pictorial vision of what happens. And with materials that like to mix a little bit better and have a higher Reynolds number in these dimensions, we can see when we run it through three cycles, we get complete mixing. So again, this shows us the dependence on this Reynolds calculation to the ability to have a fluid mixed within these this type of serpentine mixer. We can also have the fluid mixing come from the Dean effects. And what the Dean effect is, it's actually the curling, the energy, the kinetic, the energy when the fluid hits the outer wall has more resistance to it than the fluid hitting on the inner wall. So there's a pressure gradient in here. And what this pressure gradient does is it develops these vortices within this material. So actually a mixer would be these bends in here. And again, these bends, what they're going to do, we can see in this picture in the top right-hand side, what they do is they fold liquid over on itself, causing mixing. So this is known as the Dean effect. And this is another way that we can, you know, another tool of the dozens of tools or dozens of analyses that we have to do to look at microfluidics. But this is certainly an important a dissection of what happens within a microfluidic device. So the Dean number is typically denoted by the symbol D, and it's defined by this equation. And here are the parameters for this. So this shows us another picture of the multi-vortex micromixing. And basically for a low number, a low Dean number, or a low Reynolds number, this is what happens to the material. And basically as we change that number, we can see that we get more mixing within the system. So this is, I like these pictures. This shows us this, process well. And this is schematic drawings of what we can do in lithography, how we can define the mixing as a function of the Reynolds number. So this is a study of the Reynolds number and the apparent mixing and these different geometric shapes due to the exasperation of the Reynolds number, the Reynolds curvature on these devices. So they curl in and then curl out. So I thought this was a real nice work done by these gentlemen down here. They're from Texas. So this shows again the multi-vortex micro mixing. So we can have not only from the sidewalls, but when we go from a small chamber into a larger chamber, we're actually going to get these vortices mixing here, and then we get additional vortices from the outer chamber. So this is actually a system that has more than two dynamics, but two apparent dynamics. We go from one small area into a larger, and then we also have the resistance from the inner and outer walls. So we're going to have this vortices and then the other vortices in this way. So this is a multi-vortices micro-mixing application. So we also need to look at, for our microfluidic device, valves. So valves, what they do is they're going to continue flow in one direction. They prevent flow from flowing backwards. So we're going to be able to use these as a type of gate device or flapper. So this is some common applications that we could use here that you can see, and this is from the government patent website. You can take a look at how people make these flappers on the micro scale for microfluidic devices. So you're free to take a look at those links. And so when we integrate the parts together, we might use like pumps, valves, and mixers. And then we integrate these devices, these concepts together, and we build up simple devices from these components that we reviewed. So at this point, I'd like to take a break. The next presentation, what we're going to do is review the materials and the processes that are common in microfluidic devices. So the first part, again, what we did is we took a review at, looked at the basic physics of microfluidic devices in a very short amount of time. What you might want to do is take a 3-credit course alone on microfluidics and microfluidic control. It's a very interesting application here at Penn State. Even working here for 20 years, I took a few classes on microfluidics, and I actually enjoyed that engineering in there. It was pleasing to watch that kind of stuff, very intriguing. So in an area that I worked in for research, so it helped me out quite a bit. So again, I'd like to end the presentation here. Thank you for your consideration, and I look forward to talking to you the next time when we're going to look more at the materials that are common in microfluidics. Thank you.